Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi of the Device Talks, a weekly podcast. Welcome back to episode number 2 of 2025. Maybe I'll start doing episode numbers. I'm not going to go all the way back to the beginning. That's a lot to count. Episode number 2 of 2025. Very happy to bring you an interview I did with Adam Elsesser, the CEO of Penumbra. We talked at Device Talks West, and I typically like to leave those interviews unless we build a podcast around it. I try to keep most of those interviews in the in-person realm. But this was such a timely discussion, given the news that Stryker has purchased Inari, and Stryker and Penumbra are already competing in neurovascular. Now they're going to be competing in peripheral vascular. So I wanted to bring Adam's voice to the podcast. So you'll hear the interview I did with Adam Elsesser on day 2 of Device Talks West. We'll talk about Penumbra's approach to innovation, and always enjoy talking with Adam. Very thoughtful guy, and a fresh perspective from MedTech. So happy to bring you that conversation on this podcast. Before that, Jim Hammeran, the managing editor of Medical Design and Outsourcing, joins Chris Newmarker and me to talk about the leadership issue, the latest issue of Medical Design and Outsourcing, or MDO, as we call it affectionately. And he's got an excellent cover story that he'll talk about, and of a true MedTech leader. And it's a great-looking cover, too. Look for it on LinkedIn. I hope you're a subscriber, or go to medicaldesignandoutsourcing.com to see it online. But great-looking issue. Lots of great stuff in there, including an excellent piece by Kayleen Brown, our managing editor, who wrote something about the panel she led at Device Talks West. And Jim will talk about that in this conversation. Before we begin, though, don't forget that Device Talks Boston registration is open for Device Talks Boston. That's happening April 30th and May 1st. I'll be announcing some keynotes, some speakers over the coming weeks. I'll hold off on saying it here, but just bagged a big one yesterday. Very, very excited about it, and can't wait to share it with you. And then I will be opening the registration for Device Talks Minnesota, which, of course, we are bringing back, and we're very excited about. That's happening on June 11th at the McNamara Alumni Center. Device Talks Boston is happening April 30th and May 1st at the Boston Convention Exhibition Center. So lots going on here at Device Talks. You can find it all at devicetalks.com. Also on the Device Talks Tuesdays front, we've got, not next week because it's JP Morgan and everyone's going to be crazy, crazy, busy, busy. But the week after that, we have three webinars coming your way, three Device Talks Tuesday episodes coming your way, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Yes, we'll call it Device Talks Tuesday, even if it's on Wednesday or Thursday, where we'll look at what's coming up in 2025. I've got a conversation with Joe Mullings and Steve Bell about what we've seen in surgical robotics and where we're headed. You'll be able to ask questions of those two very thoughtful and opinionated and knowledgeable folks. So bring your questions to that one if you watch it live. You can also watch any of these on demand. Following that, we'll hear from Distal Motion on Wednesday. They'll talk about their approach toward building robots for the ASC. And then on Thursday, Jonathan Norris of HSBC will be sitting down with me to go over their 2024 numbers, what it means for 2025, and where the opportunities are for folks in MedTech. So lots going on in the coming weeks and the coming months, and it all starts right here with this here podcast. Let's get it started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
How are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. It's a new year. Here we are.
Right. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We can still say that. It's January 8th when we're recording, 9th when we're recording this. So we probably get another 5 days of.
And we're kind of hitting the limit, but yeah, I think we can still do it. So
yeah, we're here with Jim Hammeran. He can settle it. I think we could still say it. Chris is up against it. Jim Hammeran, managing editor of Medical Design and Outsourcing. Can we still say Happy New Year to people, or is that ship sailed?
I tend to take the Larry David position that you've got a pretty limited window, but we've got Lunar New Year coming up, right? So maybe that's when we should.
Oh, there we go.
Cut it off.
There you go.
Do it the whole month.
Happy Lunar New Year. That sounds
happy
great.
Lunar New Year. I love it. Sounds great.
All right. Well, that's not why Jim wasn't here, only to break a tie of this very, very confrontational and controversial topic. Jim, you're here to talk about the upcoming issue of Medical Design and Outsourcing. What do folks have to look forward to?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me and letting me talk about it a little bit because, you know, we're always focused on technologies and strategies for device design, development, and manufacturing. So that's, you know, at Medical Design Outsourcing, that's novel materials, advanced fabrication processes, the latest research from top universities, and tips and guidance for device designers and engineers. And that goal is really to better enable technical professionals in the device industry to innovate for better patient care. But to do that, they need support from the top of their organization. So every year we devote one of our magazine issues, it's one of our flagships, to leadership in medtech. And that edition is live at our website right now, and it's headed out to readers in the mail. And on the cover, we have an interview with Mike Muslim from Edwards Life Sciences, longtime CEO and chair. He stepped down, officially retired from the company last year when he stepped down as chair, and he stepped down as CEO a year before. So, I mean, you guys can probably guess why we wanted to talk to Mike for this leadership edition.
Yeah.
He was running Edwards and was the struggling cardiovascular unit within Baxter back in the 90s, and then led it through a spinoff, took it public as an independent company, and they were trying to figure out, well, what do we want to do? Focusing on structural heart innovation, and then about 4 years after they spun off, they acquired TAVR Pioneer PVT, so that's percutaneous valve technologies. And yeah, you know, the rest was history. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, what really stood out to me when I was talking with Mike, and this is actually something that crystallized in a follow-up interview with Stan Rowe. I know you guys have talked with him a bit. He's the co-founder of PVT. But what he crystallized for me was this focus on patients. And lots of device developers talk a lot about pushing patients first, patient centricity, that sort of thing. But the Edwards story and the TAVR story is a lot like the surgical robotics story, where surgeons told device developers that the technology wasn't necessary, and even if it was, wasn't going to work, right? So part surgeons were saying that to Edwards, but the PVT team kept pushing forward, knowing that it could disrupt business for those surgeons, and those surgeons were the primary customers for Edwards. And Stan Rowe said to me, he tells me, you know, there are a lot of times that Edwards could have bailed out on it, but he says, give Mike and the team huge credit for saying, I'm going to look beyond my key customer and work to adopt something that's disruptive to my key customer. And like we said, the rest is history. So much about that is about building culture. You know, they brought patients to campus all the time to meet with people who had their heart valves, which made a big difference for the engineers that built them, for the people that were hand sewing them, for the people that are inspecting them, and really helped coalesce the entire team behind the shared focus of, we've got to innovate to help patients who maybe don't have any other options right now and do things a better way. And now, you know, Edwards is one of the largest companies in the medical device business. Somewhere around $6 billion in sales as of our most recent medical design outsourcing MedTech Big 100 ranking. So that made them, I think, among the 23rd largest business in MedTech.
No better, I think, representation for or representative of a leader for the leadership issue. And Edwards, you're right. We had Stan Rowe on and Larry Wood from Edwards on the same episode, not on the same conversation, a few years ago. And I reconnected with Larry Wood for the Structural Heart Talks podcast we did a month or two or so ago. And just talking about those clinical trials early on, in particular, when you had patients who were getting, it was a control, so you had a group of patients who were getting it and a group who weren't. And just the level of emotion that Edwards folks had in seeing the success, seeing it help the patients who had received the implant and not really being able to help the patients who were in the group where they did not get the implant. It's a trial that I think really blazed a new therapeutic trail and left a deep imprint on the folks there. They're one of the, I think every med tech takes patients seriously, but Edwards seems to, as you indicated, take it a little bit further because of the vulnerability of the population they're helping.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, he's retired officially, but he can't keep him out of med tech. Hey, there's important work to be done. So you might have noticed last year that the Stanford Biodesign Center now bears his name. His family, the Linda Mike Muslim Foundation, gave what the university characterizes as a very generous gift. They wouldn't put a number on it. To essentially extend the program for generations, they said. But that's not all. I talked with Mike and I say, you know, what are you going to keep doing in retirement? And so he's got, through the foundation, going to be focused on continuing to innovate in medtech by using his resources. So they're focused at a high level on innovations in healthcare. And this idea of whole patient health, but also focusing on two underserved patient populations. The first is pediatric heart defects, which Mike said he was surprised to learn throughout his career how prevalent this is. This affects 1 in 100 kids born have some sort of heart defect. Some of those are very serious. Some of those are relatively minor. But he thinks that there's better care that could be innovated for them, and so he's going to be working on that. But also, he and his wife Linda, they both had older brothers that had Down syndrome, and so it's been very important for them to support ways to improve the care and quality of life for people with Down syndrome. So those are really the main four focuses of his philanthropy going forward. And we spoke a little bit about that, but he's going to have more details coming out probably later this year. So I've got more at the website, even beyond what we've got in the magazine. I mean, it was just such a great interview. I could not fit it all in the cover story, in the feature, try as I might. And I even went a little bit longer on this one. So we've got a lot of extras online at the magazine, at the website. And we've got a lot more in that leadership edition as well. Danielle Kirsch did a interview with the new FDA CDRH director, Dr. Michelle Tarver. We've got the CEO of InBrain Neuroelectronics talking about graphene and how great it is, the potential is for medtech. We talk with one of the co-founders at CMR Surgical about what he and the team learned taking their robot through the de novo pathway. We've got information about design development tips for AI medtech reimbursement, robotics coverage about how do you tackle latency and jitter if we want to get expand telerobotics in a serious way. Talk with Raj Thomas, the new leader of Medtronic Endo, a little bit about strategy and R&D and what they're hoping to do. And then our colleague Kayleen Brown had a great write-up of her panel from Device Talks West about inclusive medical device design and how it really is table stakes at this point, and all the smart companies are doing it. And then our own Sean Hooley recapped the top leadership changes of 2024, which in addition to Muslim had a whole lot of big names there. And so you can go to our website, check that out, and the magazine will be headed to readers in the mail very soon.
I was going to ask questions about all that, but you answered all my questions. So that's fantastic.
I would just say, like, especially like, you know, that big takeaway from your cover story interview. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. It reminds me of like there was an apocryphal Henry Ford quote where he said, like, if I'd given my customers what they wanted, I would have given them a better carriage. Like, it seems like really great innovation, comes from like having kind of like that imagination to and tenacity to bring something to people that they don't, that it's just not, they can't even envision it yet. And, it really seems like Tabor was one of those things. And
to that point, that innovation takes deep pockets and a real big focus on getting people out there to see the procedures, meet with patients, meet with the physicians, truly understand the needs and the conditions and go deep and go down a lot of dead ends and try a lot of things. But I think Stan said, I said, Sam, how did you do what you did with PVT under Edwards? And he said, Mike pretty much put us in a box and let's do what we need to do without interference and support when we need it, and let them play around and figure things out. And today it's an incredible procedure and much more on the way. And if you look at Edwards last year, they were one of the biggest, the most active companies in M&A. They had a couple of huge deals. I think one of theirs is still pending, but very active. So they're still growing, and a lot to come from them.
Active bringing in and active sending out as well with the vesting of the critical cares group. So
yeah,
we're looking at, this will be a brand new year of a brand new Edwards. So that'll be, again, very timely interview. So great stuff there.
We actually have some M&A to talk about in our new markers, newsmakers for the for the first of this year.
I think we need to go a little bit into lightning round mode. We've got some calls coming up, so why don't we hit number five on the new markers, newsmakers?
Well, first to start out, number five, we've got Integra Life Sciences receiving an FDA warning for quality systems issues at three locations, one in Massachusetts and two in New Jersey. And, this comes after them, previously receiving an FDA warning letter in 2023 over violations at a plant in Boston. So just unfortunately, more problems that Integra is going to have to work through with FDA. And then number four, we've got Olympus is looking for a new CEO. After their previous CEO Stefan Kaufman resigned over accusations that he bought illegal drugs. And actually, near the end of last year, Kaufman, according to newspaper reports in Japan, pleaded guilty in a court in Tokyo to an illegal drug purchasing charge. So now Olympus has their former board chair and former CEO serving as an acting CEO as they're actively searching for and evaluating CEO candidates. So that's a major medical device company. We will see who they bring on next to run Olympus.
It's certainly, still a market leader in the business that they're in. Still, I think, hold a huge market share. It seems like a company that needs, to an earlier conversation, leadership. So it'll be interesting to see who they bring in to steer that ship. So
could be a great opportunity.
What's number three, Chris Neumacher?
Well, number three on the list, this is some tough news. We have Johnson & Johnson MedTech halting carrot cases with their VARIPULSE pulse field ablation system. This was as they looked into some reports of stroke. There's some MAUDE reports, but analysts were saying, Boston Scientific and Medtronic have PFA systems on the U.S. market. As long as they don't have any similar type of issues, the analysts thought this would be a benefit, for them as they, expand use of their systems. So this is some big news and a really hot space in medtech right now. There's a lot of hope that PFA could improve ablation to treat AFib.
So there's nothing at the moment showing that this may be something tied more broadly to PFA. I mean, they all have their different approaches in distributing that or delivering that energy.
Yeah, there's nothing to show at this point.
Yeah,
not there yet. This is
definitely.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully for now, this is this is just something that J&J needs to work through. And then we have number two on the list. There were some analysts saying that they thought MedTech M&A. We actually had some big deals last year. They thought deals might pick up even more this year. And already number two on the list, we've got Boston Scientific. Spending $600 million up front to acquire intravascular
lithotripsy.
Lithotripsy.
IVL. Go with IVL.
They're going to acquire IVL platform developer Bolt Medical. So they're $600 million up front. Additional $300 million upon achievement of milestones. But this is another really hot space in medtech. This idea of using shock waves to break up calcium to treat coronary and peripheral artery disease. So Bolt Medical actually has a laser based platform. These acoustic pressure waves outside of a balloon catheter to fracture calcium. This is kind of Boston Scientific's play to get more active in this market. So very exciting.
That was an interesting deal, and the fact that they sort of created the company, they spun the technology out, created this venture, and then owned 26% of it, and then bought it back at a pretty good price. Mm-hmm. They already owned a quarter of it. So that's quite a good valuation for a company. So you have to think they feel really good about the technology that they're bringing back in-house.
Yeah, that's exciting. And then number one on the list, we've got Stryker with a – this is from Jim here. We've got Stryker with a $4.9 billion deal to buy Inari Medical. And Jim, tell us a little more about the deal really quick.
Well, if it's got my attention, you know that it's got Nitinol, something to do with it. So, you know, we reported this news. It was a big first, really, a deal of the year. It's close to $5 billion. I mean, they're paying something, they're offering something like $80 per share, which is a big, big premium from what they're trading out of the market. But both of the boards are in on this deal. They got to take it to the shareholders. And really, I mean, it's just a lot of good overlap with Stryker neurovascular business. You know, they're making device and systems for vascular access, embolization, thrombectomy, angioplasty, and stenting. And then Inari, you know, they're in these Nitinol device and systems like FlowTriever for PE, ClotTriever for deep vein thrombosis, the LymphFlow system, which they themselves bought for about $400 million back in 2023. And then they got their new Artix thrombectomy system for acute limb ischemia, which we actually, we got a real good first look of that over at Medical Design Outsourcing. If you search for Artix on our website. So, you know, it's the first big deal of the year, and Stryker points to some CDC statistics that were saying up to 900,000 people in the U.S. every year are affected by VTE. So that's a venous thromboembolism. So it's always custom subject to the usual regulatory approvals and customary closing things, but I think they're talking about closing this one. And I believe the first quarter of this year. So stay tuned.
Great stuff. Yeah, we've been waiting for Stryker to make the big deal. Chris, I know you reported earlier last year that CEO Kevin Lobo said that they were in the acquiring mood, and we were watching them take all these little smaller bites and waiting for the big gobble. And I think this is certainly qualifies as a big deal. It wasn't a surgical robotics deal that everyone's waiting for. But in terms of moving them into a adjacent but whole new space, this does that. And we'll be interesting to see them go head-to-head in the space. They're already up against Penumbra and neurovascular. Now they're going to be working against or competing with Penumbra in this space as well, in addition to others. So it's definitely a market shifter.
And Tom, talk about the foreshadowing from Device Talks West last year when you had Andy Pierce from Stryker talking about M&A strategy and deals. Really, you go back, you listen to that panel, or you look at our write-up of that panel at Mass Device, or that I should say that presentation at Mass Device, and helps this deal make a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Now, he had a lot of insights there. And, of course, the next day we had CEO Adam Elsesser from Penumbra on there. Great leaders in this space, bringing it back to leadership in medtech, and it's going to be fun to watch these two companies go at it. So, and fantastic. Well, I think that's a great round of lightning for the newsmakers, Chris Neumacher, and certainly started off on the sadder side, but I think we ended with some strong stories, and I'm surprised that they didn't wait until J.P. Morgan to release those stories. That's usually they drop the big M&A bombs, but if this is a precursor to what's coming next week at JP Morgan, then it should be a fun week for you folks at Mass Device.
Yeah, we should have a lot of exciting stuff. And you know, this one didn't even make the list, but Beta Bionics announced they're planning an IPO. So the IPOs are picking up as well. So, you know, even though we're occasionally still covering some layoffs, we're starting off feeling pretty good, you know, for the device industry this year.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, guys, for bringing us all these news and insights and stories.
Always great to be here.
That's great. And as far as the Cotton Bowl is concerned, OH.
All right. Now we'll begin our conversation, or my conversation, with Adam Elsesser, CEO of Penumbra. Before I push play on that one, though, our good friends at the MedTech Innovator are taking applications still for their 2025 cohort. The deadline, though, is January 15th, so don't wait. Go to medtechinnovator.org, and you'll find all the information right there. Well, Adam, welcome. You were here early. Thanks for making the effort to come down here and beat the traffic.
Try to beat the traffic. Thanks for having us.
Appreciate that. So
I always enjoy our conversations because you come at, I think, MedTech with a very unique perspective, and I think part of that is likely because of your background. Let's get into your path into MedTech. Most people don't find their way leading a MedTech company from being a real estate lawyer. It's not the typical career track.
Yeah.
Take us through that. How did that happen?
Purely by chance.
It wasn't planned?
Yeah, there was no plan. There was no ambition per se. And frankly, I didn't know a lot about the field. I grew up in the Bay Area. I ended up practicing commercial real estate law here in the Bay Area. I had a lot of some of the companies that were building early campuses in this area, and spent a lot of time down here in the South Bay. My best friend from college, Dr. Ronnie Bowes, became a neurointerventionalist. And just to give people a sense of timing, this was back in the 90s. So in the 1998, he was in his, I think, second year as an attending at NYU. He had gone through being a neurologist, becoming board certified, going back and doing radiology so he could actually put his hands on patients. The neurointerventional field was really early. Mm-hmm. There were less than 15 people, if I recall right, that were trained in the U.S., you know, through fellowship training to do neurointervention.
That's hard to believe.
Maybe 20. There's one approved device for neurovascular treatment at that time, the first detachable coil that Target Therapeutics did. So the field is small. You know, I knew he was doing that, but I couldn't tell you what it was he did. You know, I knew those words. And I went to New York. I had started dating a woman that I had felt hard for. We've been married 25 years, by the way, still the love of my life. And we went to New York so he could meet her and, you know, just have a nice weekend. And we had dinner with him and his wife. And after sort of going through the, you know, she's amazing hand gestures to me, he started talking about ideas he had for medical devices, which was sort of interesting for a little bit until it became clear, and not that all doctors are like this, but he started talking, and I could tell he would talk the entire time about his stuff. And I didn't really want that, but Martha was there, so I didn't want to look like a jerk, so I couldn't just tell him to shut up. So I simply said, well, look, we'll start a company, and we'll make these things. It's not that hard. And it worked. He stopped talking about it. Till the next day when he called and he said, when are we going to get together while you're in New York to start the company? You promised me, your best friend, that we would start. And, you know, here we are. The first company we started was a company called Smart Therapeutics.
You were probably like, dude, I was kidding. Like,
well, I tried that, but if you have ever met Ronnie Bowes, that's irrelevant to him that you would try to protest. He's an amazing guy, and incredibly charismatic and charming and persuasive. So, and I loved what I did. I was a partner in my law firm. I had no reason to not do it. And to this day, I cannot answer that question with any kind of real understanding. I just sort of did it. Mm-hmm. I remember going to my partners and telling them I was taking a leave of absence. They said, "What do you mean?" You know, and then we went ahead and did it. And we ended up selling that business to Boston Scientific. We then started Penumbra in 2004 with a different mission and really a different goal this time.
What was the objective of Smart Therapeutics? Talk a little bit about that.
Just the goal, we made the first stent ever to go into the brain, much struts that were much thinner, a self-expanding stent out of nitinol that had to be much thinner, lighter, at the same time have strength. It was used in conjunction with treating aneurysm, sort of stent-assisted coiling at that time. The fact that we made that product, the fact that we could get it, you know, through the FDA, was kind of a big deal. Again, there was a need for it. There were not a lot of other things at the time. We honestly didn't really understand like the idea, like how would we commercialize? Like, you know, we had already felt like we had done more than we thought we could do mm-hmm. when someone wanted to buy it. We stayed for a couple of years with Boston to sort of launch it and watch that. And that really gave us the information of like, oh, you know, this is the next phase of what a company looks like. So when we started Penumbra, we thought, you know, let's take this on and really think about blood clot, you know, in that case, in starting point in stroke, but obviously now expanded to the rest of the body a little differently and not, you know, just go and try to sell the business early on.
So what was the experience like? You said it wouldn't be that hard to start a company when you were a real estate lawyer. Sure, there were some challenges that you came up against, perhaps, that you didn't anticipate. What was the experience like of starting a medical device company, and what are one or two lessons maybe that you've applied to Penumbra?
Well, I can share some of the specific things, you know, that we had to change. I will tell you the first day that I showed up, you know, we got some inexpensive space over in the East Bay in a town called San Leandro, very cheap. Being a commercial real estate lawyer, I was focused on, you know, the cheapest possible space, and South Bay and other places were obviously more expensive. And I remember, you know, the first day I show up, I was set up to share an office with a couple of people because, you know, we're just a handful of us. And that we had these old metal desks, like, you know, you would see in an army barracks or something. The office had a small window, it was ground floor, and it looked out over the dumpster on the side of the building. And, you know, before I had a fairly nice office with a couch and all overlooking the bay in San Francisco, and I thought, you know, oh God, maybe I made a mistake. But we just, you know, we sort of figured it out. What do we need to do? Who do we have to hire? You know, we made some hires. We realized some of them didn't work, and we switched them around. And somehow we sort of, you know, stumbled through that. The one thing we did differently, it's not for everyone, but I think it helped us both in both companies, but particularly in Penumbra. We didn't. And I apologize if this is not meant as an insult to the venture capital world, but we never took formal venture capital money. I was lucky that I had law partners and clients who were willing to invest. So we took outside money, it just in a different format with a different sort of understanding and expectation, mm-hmm. so that we could make decisions. And that was true with Penumbra too, for, you know, until we obviously went public. And I think it allowed us to think a little differently and not, you know, be sort of thinking sort of in the most traditional model. And for us, that seemed to work.
That's interesting. So do you think venture capitalists coming into a startup, any startup sort of come with their own preconceived ways of doing things, and they sort of impose that or print that on the startups that they invest?
I don't know if that's true, because I've not been in that world per se. It just allowed us the ability to think the way we were thinking, mm-hmm. And it worked. You know, obviously, if it hadn't worked, I wouldn't be up here saying that was a good idea. You know, we would have screwed up, and maybe we should have learned from people who had more experience. It just, for us, it gave us a different time horizon, mm-hmm. Particularly with Penumbra, where we really, really wanted to work on the technology and keep getting it better and better. The idea of removing blood clots first in the brain and the rest of the body, we kind of sensed was going to be a long journey. And we've been at it now 20 years, and we're just now, as a company, entering the phase where everything is different, where a computer is controlling the aspiration valve, which they can do so much faster than the human hand, so you can get all this blood clot out of the body without any blood loss or any downside. It's just not possible to do with mm-hmm. the human hand. And so that journey took 20 years to get to the phase where we get to now innovate from there to the point where it's just become sort of a fairly routine procedure. That time horizon isn't typical, you know, and it's worked for us, but I doubt we would have been allowed to do that.
Did you go into Penumbra with that long time horizon in mind because you started Smart and sold it a couple of years later. How did that acquisition come? Did that come suddenly, or was that the plan? And did you just expect when you started Penumbra, we're going to do the same thing? Or did you consciously say at that time, let's build a company with a much longer runway?
I think we knew that the technology wouldn't, the first thing we had made wouldn't be the final thing.
Okay.
And it was pretty obvious. Like at the time when we started working on a product to remove clots from people who had acute ischemic strokes, we had a few things sort of stacked against us. One, most, not all of our customers or potential customers, neurointerventionalists or neurosurgeons, most of them really weren't that interested in treating those procedures. It was hard to conceive of what does that look like. They didn't have tools that would do it, so they're like, really? Like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reimbursement, There was nothing that we could patent at that time. You know, it was catheters and aspiration pumps, not patentable things. So you had three things against us. You know, most people would have looked at that as like problematic. But it was really the essence of sort of how early the field was in mm-hmm. accepting this. You know, now we look back 20 years later and it's totally different. But at that time, it was considered, you know, sort of a very different thing. And in fact, it wasn't just 10 years ago. We'd already gone public and we had gone into the vascular space and from neuro. And at an investor conference, a sell-side analyst asked about the vascular field, and they did it in the context of, but that's not a market. Like, they were challenging the fact that that wasn't a market. And it wasn't at that time, in that the definition of a market being there's a devices in that market that do things, mm-hmm. but there were lots of patients that were doing that. You know, and now, you know, you have dozens and dozens of companies trying to become thrombectomy companies. You know, my perspective, it's a little late, you know, because they can't use a computer. We do have patents finally.
Okay.
And the earlier types of things are not, you know, they're just not good enough compared to the computer. And so I think, you know, it's taken that long.
So when you started Penumbra, did you have a better office the second time go around? Did you look at a better dumpster when you started Penumbra?
We actually had moved from that original office to a next door space that did not have the dumpster in front of my office.
Upgrade. So, but did you start Penumbra? You started in the neurovascular space. So,
yeah.
Was the plan just to remain a neurovascular company? I'm kind of interested in tracking sort of the growth. You started in neurovascular, you moved to vascular, moved into a few other areas, and I suspect you have some others in mind that you may or may not share with us. But what was the plan that you laid out in 2004 when you started Penumbra? Was it we were just going to be a neurovascular company?
Yeah, that's what we knew.
Yeah.
And it was we want to deal with acute ischemic stroke.
Yeah.
And at that time, that was a huge need, a huge opportunity. We didn't really think about or plan beyond that. And it wasn't until, I think it was 2013, where physicians on the vascular side came to us, one in particular, Dr. Beninati, and said, look, your technology is clearly working in stroke. You can retool it, you know, design the right sizes, mm-hmm. and we could have an impact in the rest of the vasculature. There's huge needs there with patients with DVT, patients with PE, patients with arterial clot. And so with his help, we started to learn what that was. What are we dealing with? What kind of clot is it? What size vessels? What are the needs? And that was the start of that business
mm-hmm.
From there. And obviously at this point, that's the number of patients that have clot in those vessels versus stroke, there's just a lot more of them. And so that's become, you know, the biggest part of our business now.
That is the bigger, that is the bigger part of the business. So did that move into that area? The tech is primarily the same, but does it change the the feel of the company, the nature of the company, sort of the approach. How do you bring in, after being singularly focused, and you bring in a different business, how do you maintain the company culture that you had that's been successful up until that time?
Yeah, our company culture, you know, we have a lot. I mean, I think the company culture is better and stronger than it's ever been the more people we have. It's not, I don't maintain the culture. I think when you talk about culture as something you're maintaining, you know, it feels like you're like having to keep something. Like, you know, you're always trying hard. Mm-hmm. I think the way it sort of works at Penumbra is everyone that's been here kind of react, you know, behaves a certain way. So new people come in, they might be a little surprised, you know, they might be a little, you know, like, oh, hold on, that's not how we did it where we were. But it doesn't take long for most people, like, oh, this is kind of logical, I kind of like this. Mm-hmm. And then, so the employees of the company are the ones who maintain the culture. They're highly, you know, they train new people, they show by example, you know, how to be. And so of all the things I think about, I think the culture of the companies, that's hard to break. It's pretty strong right now.
What's the, I didn't ask you this before, and I should have Googled it. What's the origin of the name Penumbra? It's got kind of a magical kind of some fairy tale rhythm to it.
Yeah, so that's Ronnie Bose's great invention. It's not my first choice, but you know, it's pretty hard to change it now. He loved the name because of the ischemic penumbra, the sort of portion of the brain that one could potentially save, you know, when you're treating it. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a little too specific, but then I looked up the non-clinical meaning, you know, sort of in the shadow of the sun, and, you know, and I like, okay, that's kind of cool. You know, we're not trying to grab attention at the beginning. We're just doing our work and, like, proving ourselves. And so we both thought it meant different things. I will tell you a funny story. Early on, I think we had just started commercializing. So we were a teeny little company. We went, I think it was the International Stroke Conference, so a large meeting dealing with mostly, you know, treating stroke afterwards and neurologists primarily. And there was, I'm walking out of the convention center with a colleague, and he knew someone from another company, and the person came up and said to him, and I was there, oh my God, Penumbra, you guys, you were in like, everyone was talking about you all day long. And we're like, we obviously didn't have any presentations, we were a teeny little company, and she had heard the word Penumbra in clinical talks all day long, and she thought we were the ones being talked about. So maybe there was a side.
There you go. little product placement there, just to slip it in. Let's talk about R&D. You've got how did you first, what sort of R&D team did you build? Let's go back to Smart if you don't mind. And I don't know if your approach to building R&D evolved over time, but let's do start at the beginning. So how did you, what was your perspective at that early, at that startup and building the right team together to get to where you needed to go?
Yeah, at Smart, we didn't know anything. So we hired people, we had to let a few people go, like they weren't, like we just figured it out. Mm-hmm. I won't say there was much purposeful thought other than, you know, we knew what the product should be and we tried to get to that spot, and we got lucky. You know, I obviously some very talented engineers were there and helpful, but it wasn't, there was no clear intent of like, how does one structure an R&D function to be successful? We didn't know that. Mm-hmm. When we then stayed for a couple of years, you know, after Boston acquired us and watched how that worked and had a little more confidence in being more purposeful, when we started Penumbra, we had some very clear thoughts around how to do certain things, which have only gotten better and better as the R&D team themselves have sort of evolved and built their department. And I will tell you, you know, there's it's our secret sauce. It's the thing that, you know, we're 20 years in the business, and our output is without a doubt faster, stronger, more, you know, numerous than at any stage in our company's history. And that only will continue. You know, we're not running out of things to do. We're not sort of running out of room in innovation. And that's partly the field we're in, mm-hmm. you know, which has a need to keep innovating, but it's also the pace of that and the mindset and the team's view of how it's done is different than at least we've been told at most other places.
You've been given, and I remember a conversation or a talk you gave at a conference 6 years ago or so in Minnesota that I was involved with, talking about the makeup of an engineering team, the makeup of your entire workforce, but you've been very focused on ensuring that there's a diverse set of perspectives and ideas and identities in an engineering group. Talk a bit about that. How did you come to see the value in that? Because it's clearly something that's been talked about a lot more recently. It's always been important, but it's being talked a lot more about now. And how do you go about building a team like that? And then we can talk about the benefits of it, either then or in the next question.
You know, so I think you're talking about primarily, you know, we have obviously sort of a ethnic diversity, you know, just innate in being in the Bay Area. But you might be more alluding to the gender diversity mm-hmm. That we have. Just so everyone knows, about half of all of our engineers are women. It's fluctuated a little. There was one time it was above 50% a little bit. But it's routinely, since we started, been about half engineers. To address that, I'll tell a story, and then I'll sort of explain it. I got a call before COVID, so I forget what year. It's all a blur, pre-COVID versus post-COVID.
Yep.
But I got a call from someone who I think they said that they were a reporter for something called the Investigative Journalists Association or something. I was a little uptight, you know, because anytime an investigative journalist calls me, that usually is like anxious. They had been doing work for a couple of years in the Bay Area on not MedTech specifically, but the Bay Area companies, public companies, and through filings, Freedom of Information Act with the Department of Labor, getting demographic makeups of the Bay Area public companies. And they wanted to talk to me because we had more women than a percentage of more women, particularly, you know, engineering, but company-wide, than any other company in the Bay Area. And they want to talk about it. And they interviewed me and asked, what program, like, did you use to achieve that? Mm-hmm. It was a little awkward, because we didn't use a program or like a specific, it wasn't a goal per se. What we did is we just hired the best people. Mm-hmm. And kind of seems obvious that half of them are going to be women because, right, women make up about half of the population. I'm not sure that was a satisfactory answer to them, but I think when people struggle because they don't get a pool of people applying, it's not that they don't exist. Mm-hmm. So they're not applying because of the culture or the perception of the culture at the places they're applying. We get more applicants to our engineering team from women than we do from men. Hmm. And that's been that way for years.
I mean, do you think it's because the word is out that, you know, this is a place that's maybe not, maybe it wasn't intentional, but it is a place where
seems like a logical inference, but
yeah.
You know, I don't know.
So what is that? How has that helped you move Penumbra technology forward?
I think, you know, there's a fair amount of academic data that says gender diverse teams are more effective than, you know, not. So I think that's helpful, but that's not the end of the story. You mm-hmm. know, it's really how one thinks about what motivates engineers. How do you get something out of them, and what is it that you want out of your team? For us, and it's different at different companies, and so there's not a judgment in how to do this.
Sure.
It's just what works for us. If it sort of starts with how one pays people and promotes people, if you're, you know, a lot of companies in med tech have, you know, for professional staff, a, you know, a salary and then a bonus pool, you know, and you're eligible for a certain amount of bonus every year. And a lot of companies, not all, rate people, you know, the top 10% get a little more bonus, the next group gets a touch less, you know, and it's an incentive structure, you know, on paper anyway, to motivate people to work harder, to be better. What I saw when I watched that play out in particular as it related to R&D, but really in the company in general, is it actually didn't motivate the kind of behavior we wanted. Hmm. You know, if you just take it in R&D, you're gonna get graded for being on successful projects. You know, that was sort of the definition. That means projects that got approved or cleared through the FDA, or, you know, we're hitting their milestones. The projects that hit the milestones the most or the easiest are projects that are similar to other companies' products, because it's less challenging. There's less risk to it, if you will, or less unknowns to it, you know, uncertainty.
Fruit at the bottom of the tree.
So you have all the engineers wanting to be on those projects. Mm-hmm. Which is fine if that's the goal of what, you know, your priorities are. But for us, we were doing things that had never been done before. We were making products that didn't exist, that were really challenging. And so we didn't want that. We wanted to incentivize people in a different way. So as a company, we don't have a bonus system. You know, we do give people bonuses. We do give people, you know, incentives here and there. But it's not just sort of a, you show up and you get one. It's worked for 20 years. I think it's incredibly good because it doesn't create this annual pitting of your team against each other. Mm-hmm. And it keeps people more focused. We don't pay less than other people. We just don't do it in that structure. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, an important piece. But it's also what you acknowledge and reward. And doing things that have never been done before aren't always going to be a straight line. And you can't reward or judge or punish people for doing that. In fact, you want to encourage them for doing that. They're going to be more right than wrong when they're not worried about failing, mm-hmm. you know, because their job or their promotions are at stake. And so we've had some amazing stories, you know, of people, young engineers, trying things, you know, that, you know, might have at best a 50-50 chance of working. And we have stories where it hasn't worked. Who cares? You move on to the next idea. And we've had some extraordinary stories where it has worked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are obviously the fun ones to tell. but it's those that keep innovation alive, where people like remember those in the company, they've heard them and they're like, I want to try that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's sometimes the best idea. Just, you know, a handful of years ago, young 25-year-old engineer charged with, you know, designing a new catheter, had some ideas that are very different than the traditional sort of fundamental design of catheters, like, you know, what goes into the building of a catheter, and said, I would love to explore this other technology. We didn't know, like, it was at best 50-50, but we said, of course, you know, let's take a little time, go do that. And it wasn't a straight line to the right answer, but she got there, and all of our next wave of catheters have used this technology that no one had used before in any catheter. I saw a small startup talking about this same type of technology recently as the new novel thing, and I showed it to the young engineer and like, look at this. This was you, remember? 4 years before that startup, but that's okay.
Do you think this, going back to your comment about venture capital, again, do you think you have the leeway to do things this differently if you had VCs on your board?
You know, I've never had VCs, so I don't know. Yeah. It certainly made it easier because I didn't have to ask permission. So obviously that made it easier for us. But I don't know if what that looks like in that environment. It just, I didn't have to think about it.
And going back to your earlier point about how you didn't have patents on your early products, was that a decision?
By the record, all of our computer stuff has a lot of patents.
The patents, the newer ones, yeah.
And I used to be a lawyer, so just be careful. Oh, sorry.
Just watch it. No, but earlier on, I think we were talking before, and I wasn't sure if it was you, the material you're working on, you were not able to patent, or I inferred from our conversation that you actually opted not to get patents to sort of just inspire your engineers to keep moving forward, kind of a burn the boats kind of thing, like lift.
Yeah, we
There's nothing protecting our rear.
Like. We have some patents on some of our earlier stuff. None of it was foundational to our products. When we went public 10 years ago, that came up a lot. Like, hold on, you're a 510K product with not any patent protection. What is this? and what we said, and then what we did, was we will just continue to out-innovate people. And you can only do that when there's a huge runway of need to go. You know, innovation just to make it different doesn't matter. But there was a long runway to keep making the products better and better and better. And we've just been doing that over the last 10 years. And so we've just stayed ahead of everyone who's following because we just keep doing that. And that, you don't need patents to do that. But at some point, and now that we're moving into the computer world where this is where it will reside, this is how one will get blood clot out, you know, for many, many years, it's nice to actually have some pretty strong patents.
Absolutely. This may be a reach, but I'll just ask a question. Do you think that going back to your engineering team and the gender balance of that, has that influenced the design of your products in that we're having conversations with folks about creating devices that are meant to treat people of different statures, of smaller statures? Does having that, how do you think having that, the makeup of your engineering team influence the design of your products? Or are they already pretty neutral already?
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily tied to it. I think it's really just having a broader working sort of capacity. You know, we don't really have a sameness of thought with the team we have. No one feels like they just sort of have to do what we've already done. In fact, they're challenged all the time to, you know, do something very, very different. And the way we've structured it is people all get excited and cheer each other on. So right now we have a new product we just kicked off. We put together a team on it, three engineers, each trying a different thing, you know, to see if we can get there. But unlike in a lot of places where that would become competitive, you know, like I want my thing, no one thinks that way. Mm-hmm. It's like they're sort of all doing it together to see which of those three things turns out to be the most effective, and then they will all be part of that success. And that's, it's just hard to express, but that's, you know, that's sort of how they are with each other. Mm-hmm. And so by definition, you're gonna get a much better shot at success when you have that thought process.
That's great. So the final area I want to talk about is your immersive tech, your VR project. When you had mentioned that when you're a neurovascular company, you surprised analysts by telling them, look, someday our vascular business is going to be bigger than our neurovascular. When I talked to you a couple of years ago, you were very high on the immersive tech, and you thought that was going to be a big part going forward. Unfortunately, you had to shutter it this summer. Talk a bit about how you moved into that space, which is not necessarily tangential or adjacent to what you're doing, and what ultimately led to the outcome.
I appreciate it. And it's sort of, you know, the headline of the talk is knowing the difference between risk and uncertainty. this is a perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, risk is something one quantifies, you know, and then you sort of do a calculation of this is how much risk, this is the reward. That's typically done for things that are known, you know, because you otherwise can't quantify the risk if it's unknown. Uncertainty is uncertain. You have no idea. You can't, like, you're sort of just giving a shot. We like uncertainty because it means the products don't exist. You know, mm-hmm. we're doing something that doesn't exist. When we started trying to figure out how to take blood clot out using aspiration, it didn't exist. So we were making it up. There was no way to quantify it. Using virtual reality, then, you know, we called it immersive healthcare, to help patients, particularly starting out, stroke patients, but then broader issues around physical rehab in general, and then ultimately some mental health issues. The technology behind VR was uniquely set up for that. And I just, you know, as a background, I think the idea of virtual reality for the larger world is dumb as hell. I don't get it. I don't want to wear a headset and live in a fake world. But the idea of using, sorry if anyone's from Meta, I honestly, when you see it and realize how one is after a stroke, and the idea that you can trigger or trick the brain to do things that it can't do right away because of your stroke, it's an amazing tool for helping people. And it was just obvious the first time, you know, we were introduced to it. So we thought, look, if we can help, you know, get the clot out faster, but also then help with rehab, that's a noble thing. We should try that. And then we started doing it, and we started working with patients and seeing the patients benefit, and we're like, this is actually working, you know. So we kept investing in it because of what we saw the patients were feeling and doing. And it broadened from there. And we then entered into a partnership with the VA. We treated a huge number of veterans, which, you know, to be honest, was incredibly important and profound to see, you know, anybody get better, but, you know, particularly our veterans.
Sure.
And the goal had been, we have to find a pathway where this is a financially viable business. And we did a lot of things to try to do that. We tried countless things, and it became clear that that was going to be really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily impossible. You know, I'm hoping someday somebody does it, because we know that patients benefit. But it also coincided with our core business in thrombectomy evolving to the point where we have the computers now orchestrating all the aspiration source, and the runway, the opportunity in front of us to treat, you know, the next 90% of patients who have clot in their body that aren't getting this treatment, you know, which is almost another million people in the U.S. alone, let alone the rest of the world, that required our full-time effort,
mm-hmm.
And our full energy and investment, because that opportunity really wasn't clear but when we started immersive healthcare. And so as that opportunity became clearer and immersive healthcare became less clear, you know, it became a fairly obvious decision.
Interesting. Okay. Is there another immersive healthcare kind of step for number? Are you always looking for that either a third leg or just a new adjacency?
It's a good question. We're not actively looking for anything. Right now, our focus is on thrombectomy all over the body. Again, as I said, that opportunity to help that many more patients is extraordinary, and it's sort of righteous work. A quick story: 2 weekends ago, I got an a text that had a video on it, and I know this, you know, happens with everyone who has products that save lives, but it was a text. There was a firefighter who had was also 39 weeks pregnant, had a very serious PE, massive PE, went to the hospital, coded on the table, and they revived her and then used our Flash 2.0 to save her and then deliver and save her baby.
Wow.
And the video was of her being discharged from the hospital with her husband and her baby and walking out and having a line of firefighters in uniforms, you know, greeting her. And, you know, this is why we're all in med tech, right? This is the point. And I watched it 6 times that Saturday. I cried every single time. It was profound. So, you know, our focus is on that. We want to make sure all of those patients, not just firefighters, but everyone else, cops too, all are treated so that they're not lost in the system. So that's our focus. If other things come along, you know, we'll look at it, but right now my impression and intention is likely to be focused on that huge opportunity we have to do that work. And that, you know, once we get to where, you know, we're treating everyone, then yeah, we'll need something else then.
Going back to your origin story, I guess you wouldn't get many videos like that as a real estate attorney. It probably validates your decision even more.
I'm still close to some of my old law partners. And
no offense to any law lawyers. No.
Some did pretty well because they invested in Penumbra.
All right, great. Adam Elsesser, thank you for joining us here at Device Talks.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great. Thank you, guys.
Excellent. Great. Thank you.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, you can share this episode on LinkedIn. When you do, connect with me, Chris Newmarker, or Jim Hammeran. Let us know what you're talking about. We'd love to be part of your future MedTech conversations. Connect with Kayleen Brown while you're in the connecting mood. Please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. It's always great to have more folks listening. And, of course, give a shout-out, a review, anything on your podcast application so we know you're out there and it helps other folks find the podcast. Once again, we have our virtual What's Happening in 2025 series happening not next week, but the week after that. Go to devicetalks.com to register for those events. They are free. You can watch them live or on demand. If you watch live, you can ask questions. If you watch on demand, you can just enjoy other people asking questions and you'll just regret forever that you didn't ask your own. So I would just watch live and it's free either way. Go to devicetalks.com. You can find information about those upcoming discussions, find information about Device Talks Boston, find out information about Device Talks Minnesota, and of course, the Device Talks Podcast Network. If it sounds like a lot, it is a lot. We're very busy over here. But we are loving our jobs and love bringing this great content to you. All right, folks, thanks for listening to this episode of the Device Talks, a weekly podcast. I'll have another episode for you coming up just a week from now. Take care, everybody.